Movie BS with Bear and Snyder.
Jeff and Eric were walking through the woods one night. That's right. When they saw something giving off an eerie light, so bright. Turned out it was an alien meteorite. That's right. And its radiation gave them superhuman insight. So bright.
And on that day, they vowed to use their powers for good instead of evil, swearing to protect mankind from the vile clutches of their evil arch-nemesis, Bad Cinema. And if you find yourself in a bind at the multiplex, not sure what to watch, you too can call on
Movie BS with Bear and Snyder.
Hello and welcome to Movie BS with Bear and Snyder, the only movie podcast on the internet. I'm your host, Eric D. Snyder, here with my sidekick, Jeff Bear.
Sidekick no more. I am co-host Jeff Bear. That is my, I'm just going to say you're my co-host.
Oh, thanks.
You're my co-host, Eric D. Snyder.
Thanks.
And here we go. Another rousing edition of Movie BS.
Mm-hmm. Another arousing edition. Is that what you said?
We always start the show with an iTunes review. It's what we do.
We sure do. This is our 297th episode. Episode 297. We've begun every show with an iTunes review.
You can go back and check.
Mm-hmm. Fact check us if you want.
Yeah,
and
you could.
And here, this is written by Chaotic Fish.
Ooh, I have a request for this one.
Yes.
Could you do this one in old-time radio voice?
Ah, what an interesting idea.
Let's try it out, see if it works.
Let me give it a
shot. Maybe
okay.
That'll be a thing.
Chaotic Fish writes, a swell audio delivery of film reviews. Good day, fair viewer of various comments of Talking Pictures podcasts. Perhaps this short review of a podcast about reviews will catch your eye. This duo of comedic critics do a dandy job of giving a fair shake at most of the recent Talking Picture shows available in the theaters. Enjoy this totally sensible podcast and give it a listen. Thanks, Chaotic Fish.
Yeah.
Thanks for the review. And you guys, listen.
I like it when we're referred to as dandy.
Mm-hmm. Me too. If you write us a review on iTunes. On iTunes? iTunes.
Should have gone with A-Tunes because it would have shown up soon.
They went all the way through A through H before they arrived at I. If you write us a review, we'll read it on the show. That's what I was going to say.
That's right.
But then also, wait, there's more.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-uh.
Yeah, we have a lunch sponsor today.
All right.
Our lunch sponsor, anyone also, we'll pimp your product if you buy us lunch. Go to moviebs.com and there's a link to our perpetual lunch fund.
I believe it's top right, but nobody's keeping score, really.
This is Kevin Duncan. Devoted listener Kevin Duncan has written a book, and it's called The Little Scary Book. And he describes it as 10 tales of horror for anyone who was ever young. So it's little horror short stories.
And geared at adults about your childhood?
Well, you know, that's a good question.
Thanks.
I haven't read the book.
Got
that's
it.
That's the description he gave me.
I noticed something, and we'll see how quickly people actually check this out. If you go to our website,
Before you say whatever you're going to say, let me finish saying our lunch sponsor.
But then it was going to extend, and then we'd go back to him, and people are like, "I don't even remember what was the name of that book."
Scary Book, Kevin Duncan. It's on Amazon Kindle. If you got the Kindle Unlimited, it's free. If you don't have the Kindle Unlimited, it's 99 cents.
Oh, no.
So for a buck.
Oh, yes.
A buck, you get these 10 little short stories.
Huh.
The little scary book.
I need a collection of short stories because there's times when, man, those books that are like over 150 mm-hmm. pages, they're just too daunting. Right, people?
Or like even really a thick magazine. Yeah, it's too much.
Thick magazine. That doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. That could have been your stage name.
Thick magazine?
Now to the stage.
That is a terrible stripper name.
But anyway, we need to update something on our website because if you go to Movie BS and then if you look at the Movie BS Perpetual Lunch Fund, it looks like you're clicking a video of some sort. Like, it thinks it's an Adobe Flash player.
Yeah, that's some kind of GoFundMe thing. We need to fix that. We need to get the tech guys on that.
Oh, we do. We need tech guys.
So, yes, if you'd like us to pimp your product, be it a book of short stories you've written or your website or your human trafficking ring, whatever you do, we'd be glad to promote it on the show if you – I think we said at least $25.
I don't know.
Yeah,
but to be honest, well, I was going to say we're flexible, but let's be honest. I can barely touch my toes.
That's true. Hopefully – we need at least 25 of you to go buy Kevin Duncan's book to justify his expense.
That's right.
His lunch.
So, do it for Kevin.
Get on
do it for
guys.
Us. Do it for us and then do it for Kevin.
25. That's like if all of our listeners buy the book twice.
I don't think that's the case.
Let's talk about movies. Reviews of movies specifically.
Where would you like to go to first?
Deadpool. I'm sure you're super familiar with this comic book character, right?
Yep. He was in one of the X-Men movies and people were up in arms. That's Deadpool.
Yeah, he was Ryan Reynolds in that X-Men Origins Wolverine. Mm-hmm. I found the scene online to refresh my memory. It didn't work. I don't remember it, but I believe that that scene was in the movie because I did see the movie.
It was foolish of me. I think I rewatched that movie for some reason, or maybe it was on TNT at some point in my life, and I decided to keep watching it. And it was just that affirmative thing of like, well, this is a bland movie that I'm not interested in. But I remember Ryan Reynolds had is it Wade Wilson?
Wade Wilson, yeah.
The former Minnesota Vikings backup quarterback, I believe. Wade Wilson.
Interesting.
But anyway.
Deadpool. He's in the X-Men family. He's a mutant.
He's a mutant, but oh boy, does he have a mouth on him.
Man, a potty mouth, this guy.
Oh, ooh, come
boy.
On. Yeesh.
Oh, man. He swears so much he'd knock a buzzard off a shit wagon.
He's foul-mouthed. He's sarcastic, and he knows he's in a fictitious superhero movie.
He's self-aware.
Yes.
He also has no problem. In fact, he's very eager to kill the bad guys. Like, not arrest them or turn them over to justice, but just go ahead and kill the bad guys.
The anti-Batman in that regard. Batman doesn't kill, right?
Generally. Anti-Superman. I bet Batman swears. You know Batman swears. He'd have no compunction about swearing.
Well, he might swear, but we've never had an R-rated Batman.
No, he can't in the movies. But in real life, Batman swears, I'm sure.
This will be – in real life. This will be interesting to see if there's an audience that pays to go see this movie. Because I think what would happen would be this wouldn't be the last R-rated superhero movie that we would have seen if this makes money.
No, well, I think if nothing else, there will be Deadpool right. 2.
Is it automatic? Is that definitely happening already?
Oh, people were tweeting today that it's already in the works. Yeah.
Oh, it's official.
The movie hasn't even opened yet. And already, they're putting all their eggs in that basket. And so he does swear, and he's fun, and he's snarky, and he has sex a lot, and all that. Which is like you say, that's different from what we've gotten from the superhero movies. But it is ultimately just another superhero origin story.
It's
structured a little different in that we start with him already as Deadpool, and then he freezes and flashbacks to how it came to be.
Yeah,
but other than that, it's not really any different from the others, which is fine. It's just
It's slightly structurally different, and then the tone of the lead character is the difference here.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's one action scene of a chase on a highway. And like two significant, very long flashbacks from that, and then the final battle. I think, unless I'm forgetting something.
Something like that.
But that's it.
And even there, the more that I think about it, take away the swearing and his attitude, the snarkiness, the sarcasm. We've already seen that in the Avengers.
And Guardians of the Galaxy.
Guardians of the Galaxy, yes, especially.
His
self-awareness. The fourth wall is really the only genuinely different thing about this from other superhero movies. But even then, at one point, he points out that he's breaking the fourth wall, which kind of ruins it. That's sort of like – it's all the way around, it's like the safe studio version of being edgy and hip. And like he sort of cracks on other superheroes, but only other superheroes who are owned by 20th Century Fox, the X-Men.
Right.
So it's all still very, corporate.
It's corporate, but it is.
But it's fun.
It is fun, and that's the weird thing. I think the key of what you were just saying, there's one sentence that seems to be the key, or at least it was the beginning of one, and it was when you said, the more I think of it. Mm-hmm. This is not a movie.
Is that my problem right there?
This is right. Like, I think this movie comes down to, hang on a second. Did you have a good time when you were sitting through it? Mm-hmm. Doesn't necessarily need to be revisited to be a good movie. Doesn't necessarily need to be overanalyzed to be a good movie, because there is something about it that does feel fresh and unique in the start.
In the moment, yeah.
In the moment. Like, while you're watching it, it does feel appreciated. And I think all of this hinges on the fact that, how do you feel about Ryan Reynolds? How do you feel about the Ryan Reynolds now? He's always had this sarcastic tone. He's mm-hmm. using it well here.
He's the kind of, I think, probably the perfect choice for this character.
I think he is the perfect choice. Yes, and the way that he's happy to point the finger at himself. In fact, the real Ryan Reynolds, he's totally fine with that. Really good opening credits. That helps a lot with the fact that that's where it has something unique to say about the formula of superhero movies, because the opening credits just 100% references the fact that, like, yeah, generic hot girl and so on and so forth.
Gratuitous cameo and yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. All of that stuff.
That's funny.
And that's good. But other times it does feel like, okay, you're pointing it out, but that doesn't necessarily make it funny.
Right.
At times, but there's a lot of flying humor here. Who's the bartender?
TJ Miller.
TJ Miller. Such an easy fit for TJ Miller to be sarcastic toward the Wade Wilson Deadpool character. And
the story, by the way, Wade Wilson, Special Forces, then he's like a goon, like a hired goon to beat up other bad guys or something.
Right.
Then he meets a hot chick, falls in love,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
gets cancer, tries an experimental treatment suggested by really a clearly untrustworthy psychopath. Like, I don't know why he thought that was going to turn out well for him. And ended up the way he is now, ghastly, but he can regenerate lost limbs and whatever. And right. He's looking for vengeance.
Yeah, and the evil Ajax, who I guess probably existed in X-Men, he is such a token villain, except for one time where he's going a little bit overboard with torture.
Yeah.
Like, there's kind of a moment there that maybe separates him a little bit from other villains, but otherwise, it is always weird that an origin story can't also nail a villain. Mm-hmm. Like, why is that so difficult?
I think this one seems like it thought it didn't need one. Thought it was going to get by just on the charm and the humor and the outrageousness mm-hmm. of it, and that we would overlook the fact that there's not really a good villain.
But then you have two others, the X-Men that they could afford, Colossus, which is the CGI character, and he's a good counterpoint. He's a do-gooder who doesn't understand why Deadpool has to be mean.
Yeah,
and then a cranky Negasonic Teenage Warhead,
which is a pretty good name for a mutant. Yes. I'll give him that.
It totally is, and it was
that, like, should have been my stage name, Thick Magazine.
I think I finally figured out, like, by the end of the movie, I was like, all right, I think I understand her powers. Not that it matters.
No, I don't.
But yeah, like, it is weird how much fun you have, and then you're just like, oh, that was empty calories, and I think I'm okay with that.
So empty. And also, adding to that, it'll be dated. 2 years from now, when you rewatch this to prepare for the sequel, you cringe at how many dated references there are. Which, again, adds to the idea that this is, you watch it once, it's disposable, you forget about it.
That's what movie that, like, it really kept reminding me of in that disposable way?
Hmm.
Kick-Ass.
Yes.
Kick-Ass was a lot of fun the first time I saw it. And maybe that had slightly to do with seeing the premiere at South by Southwest and just, like, the crowd eating it up and everybody
also
having a good time.
Also self-consciously violent, and look uh-huh. how violent and taboo we are.
Look, we're breaking superhero rules here, but not quite.
Yeah.
And yes, I do wonder if I revisit the first Deadpool, Is it going to be like that time where it's like, you know, sitting through Deadpool 2, wow, this really didn't work, Kick-Ass really didn't work, and then you watch the original and you're like, oh, some of the shine's gone on off that one too. Mm-hmm. But for the moment, heck of a ride, good time.
I give it a B.
I give it a 7 out of 10.
So that's Deadpool. And then there's another movie.
More?
Uh-huh. Zoolander 2. Ooh, speaking of sequels, that it will probably be a bad idea.
Oh, boy.
It bothered – the first Zoolander came out right after 9/11. I remember that. Because Roger Ebert's review, he hated it basically because it was too soon after 9/11 to have a comedy.
Yeah.
he later expressed regret for that extreme position he had taken. So I remember when it came out. So that's, you know, 14 and a half years ago. And so when you wait that long for a sequel, when the sequel does finally come around – it's very disappointing when you realize they didn't make this because they finally had a good idea for a sequel. Their idea was, hey, let's make a sequel.
Right.
And that's so disappointing.
It's, man. And what they attempt to do here, specifically in the beginning, they just go bigger. Like, it is the idea, like, there's, you know, slick special effects. There's an action sequence to start it off. Mm-hmm. There's excessive graphics and a grandiose story that we're supposed to be kind of sort of paying attention to. And the weird thing is there's very little humor to kick it off.
So low.
And then you're like, okay. But, like, you know, once we finally relax with these characters, once we finally bring Zoolander back, once we finally bring Hansel back, once all of that happens, I'm sure we'll find those moments of comedy just like we did with the first Zoolander. Because
once they
get in the groove, once they move through all of this, like, excessive plot setting up, then I'm sure we'll be fine. And once it's set up, they keep kind of going for these bigger set piece swings. Like, it felt like they were spending a lot of money on a movie that didn't need it. Like, nobody was like, mm-hmm. oh, okay, if we're making a sequel to this movie, we got to go big budget. Like, nobody was feeling that way, right? That would actually sit down and enjoy this movie.
They, yeah, time has passed in this, and they fill us in on what Derek and Hansel have been up to in the last 14, 15 years. Mm-hmm. When they first come back, they've fallen out of favor. And so when they first come back, I like where they were going with it at first, where they're out of touch now, where fashion culture has changed. I like, there's a character, Don Attari, played by Kyle Mooney, who's like the cool modern fashion designer who's grungy and ironic, and he loves things because they're terrible. And yes, Hansel and Derek don't get it. And I like that these models now feeling like, whoa, this culture has changed too much.
That is a good idea.
It's a fine idea. And even their discomfort with the Benedict Cumberbatch ungendered model named All. And I laughed a little bit about that, about not like transphobic, but just sort of,
right,
whoa, this is more than I was expecting. I'm not prepared for this.
Yes, like, I don't have an understanding of how culture works now.
Right.
That, like, it's almost that idea of, like, the Austin Powers. Mm-hmm. But they didn't focus on that much at all.
No.
That kind of goes away. And instead, it's almost like Ben Stiller was attempting some sort of weird Mission Impossible kind of thing, where it's like, we'll jet set. We'll go to all of these different locations, and that will be important.
Well, and if you remember, the first one was about these dumb male models, but then it also had this sort of Mission Impossible kind of plot with the attempted assassination and the conspiracy and the world leaders and stuff. And so I feel like here for the sequel, they thought, okay, we need to do something else like that. We need to continue that idea. But that's not what was funny the first time. It was the models and their dumbness and model culture and their vanity. That's what was funny. And so all this business now with there's a chosen one and the fashion designers are getting together and all that stuff is unnecessary.
That's unnecessary. It's weird. Like, this isn't much of a spoiler at all. I mean, it's discussed in the beginning. Derek Zoolander's wife is dead, mm-hmm. played by, you know, his real life wife. I think they're still together.
I think so. Christine Taylor.
And then there's definitely something. There's a son that is involved later on. And there's some like ranting stuff where it's just like the reasons why the son wouldn't love Zoolander. And part of me is like, what is Ben Stiller working on here? Like, is he working on his father-son relationship with his dad or with his kids? Like, because this isn't a joke, really. So what's going on? And I got to be honest, it took me the entire movie and the friend that was with us for me to understand that that was Kristen Wiig.
I like her character, Alexandra Etoz, and she's an Italian fashion designer, and her accent is such that she puts the wrong vowels in words, and it kept giggling me.
Here's the thing. When did you know it was Kristen Wiig?
I thought it was her about 20 minutes in, and then I thought, no, I don't think it is, and then later I decided that it was.
Do you know who I locked in on?
Who?
Because if you look at that face – it 100% looks like an old Miley Cyrus. Plastic surgery Miley Cyrus is what that face looks like. And for a long time, I was just like, so this is Miley Cyrus. Okay. Well, I've seen her be funny on occasion on Saturday Night Live. I should give her the benefit of the doubt. What's this character really doing here? Okay. I don't know.
I don't really think she looks like Miley Cyrus.
I think it looks exactly. And maybe I just don't
know. I think
know
it looks more like Kristen Wiig than Miley Cyrus.
Maybe I just don't know what Miley Cyrus looks like enough. But anyway, it was that thing where I was just like, this is a one note. And for me, I really did feel like unless you know it's Kristen Wiig doing something funny, it just doesn't feel funny enough. And that was kind of even – man, when Will Ferrell finally shows up in this film – like, it's good that he's there, but
it's
then
not enough.
It's not enough. It is just – it's a bad movie.
It kept feeling like they were trying too hard. The jokes where the models are dumb and where they use the wrong words, most of those fell flat. They felt like a reach.
Yes.
The whole thing just feels creaky and stumbling and just not
and
connecting.
Hansel and his orgy – man,
he married an orgy.
Yeah, it did not get nearly enough laughs to no. like keep going back to that thing. And it was just like, all right, what are we doing here? Why are we hanging out with these people? They relied on cameos and having a bigger like budget and thinking that that would replace humor. There was no dance off. There was no like this is the thing. It felt like it was actually attempting to find new humor. Mm-hmm. Or just doing something different. And sometimes, you know, if you are going to do a sequel, just look at what really worked in the first one and try to find a new way to repeat that.
Right.
Sometimes that's okay to do. But, like,
it's got a million cameos, and I was impressed and amused for a while, especially at the little ones that didn't mean anything. Like, suddenly, oh, there's Susan Sarandon. All right. Or, hey, there's Willie Nelson saying, hey, where's the party? And those, because they don't get in the way, they don't slow it down. And those, I'm amused by that. But, eventually too many of them.
Hang on a second. I'm just looking at the list. Was Macaulay Culkin in this movie?
No, there's a bunch of people listed on IMDb who are not in it or who didn't wind up in the final cut. I'm sure there were even more that got cut out.
I'm sure there
I did like Fred Armisen as an 11-year-old boy. Girl, I don't know, 11-year-old child who's like a publicist or something, because they went to the trouble of putting Fred Armisen's face on a child's body, and I just kept thinking how expensive that must be, and what a waste of money it is for how funny it is, which to me makes it even funnier. Because let me tell you why. My comedy troupe back at BYU, the Garens, we discovered very early on that the more money we spent on props or costumes or whatever, the less funny the sketch was going to be. That became a hard and fast rule almost immediately. And so it just reminded me pleasantly of that phenomenon.
It was that thing where – I'm just trying to – even Penelope Cruz, all right, so you're there, big deal. And oh my God, really a cat fight at the end? Like that's supposed to be – man, it just and how many times can we hear Zoolander like say something wrong and that's the whole joke, like a total laughing stick? instead of stock, right? I think that was a line. Like, and it was just like, yeah. What is that? That's not good enough.
Yeah, very disappointing. Even more so because, like, this, I would be less disappointed if this had come out the next year. Like, as a quick turnaround, fast and easy sequel. But when you wait 14 and a half years, you sort of give the impression that you were waiting until you had a good idea.
Like, maybe you had one joke each year, so now there's going to be 14 really good jokes in this movie.
Yeah, no.
Nope.
It's a C-.
It's a 4 out of 10.
And then there's the counter-programming. This is for Valentine's Day. You got the Deadpool for the guys, I guess. Kids, teenagers, probably.
Sure.
People who have to sneak in. And then you got whatever we just talked about, Zoolander 2.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the same basic crowd. And then for girls, there's How to Be Single.
Girls.
That really is kind of what they're going for.
I guess, yeah.
And this, it's an R-rated comedy. It sounds like, we talked about this before, How to Be Single sounds like it's going to be a romantic comedy with Kate Hudson.
Yes.
Because it reminds me, it's like, he's just not that into you, or that kind of thing. And it turns out it's written by the same people.
He's just not that into you. Right. Yeah. And this, it is weird because it is your standard, I guess, these are rom-coms, right?
It's a pretty standard, it's the kind of rom-com that it's an ensemble with multiple storylines. Yeah. Several main characters.
It's the good version of the awful Valentine's Day.
It also reminded me of Love the Coopers from last fall, that Christmas movie, also had Jake Lacy. But having these different plot lines with different characters that are all kind of connected.
Right. And it's pretty white people in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's it.
There is one black guy, Damon Wayans Jr., and thread – is one of the worst in the movie, like totally underdeveloped. And I realized I was able to pick apart the movie very distinctly by certain threads work and certain ones don't. And his is one that I think doesn't work, and they rush through it too much, and all they do with that character doesn't work. But then there's others that I really like. Let's run down who we have here.
Okay.
We got, we're in New York City, obviously, because it's a romantic comedy.
Yeah,
that's the rules. Alice, played by Dakota Johnson, from that 50 Shades of Grey.
Right.
And from the loins of Don Johnson and Melanie Griffith.
And once again, naive and single.
Mm-hmm. I like her. 50 Shades of Grey was my first exposure to her. But I like her.
I think she can stick around. Mm-hmm. She's in Hollywood standards only. She has a look that is not she's not intimidatingly beautiful.
It's more like girl next door beautiful. That's what they say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. But I mean, again, by society, she's like intimidatingly beautiful. But sure. Yeah.
And then Rebel Wilson is Robin. She's the chubby comic relief.
She's the comic relief.
Comic relief. Yeah. That's true. They don't make an issue of her weight, but they also don't let her like have a boyfriend, which they said that character just doesn't want one. But that kind of is how it always is in movies.
But you know the real reason.
Well, show me the last movie that had a fat side character who wound up with someone at the end.
Bridesmaid.
Did she wind up with someone at the end?
Yeah. Really? Her real life husband.
Oh, yeah. There you go. All right. The exception that proves the rule, if that's even true.
Mm-hmm. And then we got Meg. Meg is Leslie Mann.
Mm-hmm.
And She's a hardworking doctor who doesn't have time for anybody or anything, and she likes it that way.
OBGYN. So she delivers babies, doesn't want one.
By the way, she's an OBGYN, not a pediatrician,
right?
Which is weird because, like, yes, there's a scene where she definitely delivers a child. But otherwise, for some reason, it's like she's always seeing babies at work, which isn't necessarily the case for an OBGYN.
I think only once. But that is the baby that makes her decide she wants a baby of her own. Maybe it's, it's a late follow-up appointment, maybe.
If she wouldn't have had 20 seconds alone with a baby, she would have never wanted to be a mother.
And,
interesting.
And is there another? Oh, yes. And then Allison Brie is the type A, tightly wound. She wants to find a partner. by running algorithms on all the dating websites,
right,
which they mention early on and then never again. And that, like, she meets, has a couple of dates, but then everything after that is all, has nothing to do with that.
It's 100% an excuse. Like, why would a type A personality hang out alone at a bar?
Well, it's like, okay, free Wi-Fi
free Wi-Fi, and then we can work around that and blah, 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 blah.
Remember when she was trying to use the Wi-Fi from upstairs in her apartment and she dropped her laptop out the window and it smashed on the ground?
Must have bought a new one.
And in the next scene, she's sitting at the bar with a new laptop?
Hang on a second. There's only one scene that we should be talking about for next scene. And that is when Alice and David...
David's the black guy.
End up passing each other on the street, having a pseudo first date, but not technically... And then in the next scene, breaking up.
3 months later, the words on the screen tell us. Yeah, that felt
and
like
we are supposed to emotionally connect on some level with this, which is outrageous. Like, talk about dumb. Like, so dumb it's ridiculous.
I suspect that there were scenes in there that they just cut to streamline the movie. I suspect that's what happened there, but it totally ruins it.
Alice, like, while Dakota Johnson is likable, the character of Alice is a little bit annoying because she's trying to find happiness alone. She's trying to move on. She's always been in relationships or under the umbrella
since,
of her
like,
parents.
Since, like, her first day of day of college, she's been in a relationship.
But the fact that she associates, like, being alone as not understanding how a router works and, like, needing somebody with her as a partner to help her with tasks, that's kind of annoying. And they don't focus on that as annoying. They focus on it as, like, somehow it's an adorable quality or something like that. And we should be better about.
Although it's also fairly plausible. If she has been living with a guy since the day she left home, then she probably is a pretty inexperienced and immature young woman.
And the simple way to fix that is Robin making fun of her and putting her down about that, and then that being a goal of hers in a good way. And then suddenly that works. But Stella, the beer Stella, clearly a sponsor in this film. So that was interesting to know.
A guy named Ken, played by Jake Lacy. Who's he with again? He's with who does he date?
Wait, which one's Jake again?
The other one. Oh, he winds up with Leslie Mann. Okay, so Leslie Mann, the OBGYN.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wait, this one's
This is like a bingo card of rom-com plots because Meg, the OBGYN, decides she wants a baby, gets artificially inseminated, and then meets a guy.
Mm-hmm.
Who she doesn't tell is pregnant because no rom-com can survive without someone lying to their partner.
So annoying. So annoying that she's just like, I don't want to tell him yet. What's really weird here is I really liked his character in Obvious Child, and that character has a really different path with rushing into a relationship than this one. It's almost opposites, but not quite. Mm-hmm. But just kind of weird that he's like, at some point he must have been like, is this too, like, am I being typecast as the guy that finds himself in a relationship with a pregnant woman and then something happens?
Maybe if that's what you're good at, you know, play your strengths.
That's his wheelhouse.
Anders Holm plays Tom, who's a bartender and, you know, a promiscuous, fooling around kind of bartender guy, nothing serious, who sleeps with everyone. Rebel Wilson, I think, is really funny. And I like her character in this movie. I kind of, as stereotypical as it is to have, you know, the one that's separate and doesn't wind up with anyone, I also do like having a character who's kind of not involved in all the nonsense, just kind of commenting on it and being an agent of chaos. And she is a party girl who doesn't care about anything, sex hungry. And she does hook up a lot, and good for her. But I like her commentary. And she at times almost seems like she's in a different movie. Like she's in a more self-aware kind of spoof of rom-coms than this actually is.
Yeah, and the thing for me in general, I can't stand when movies do the thing where it's like they have a new term. They come up with a new term, and they decide audiences are idiots. So not only are we going to use the term in a very obvious way, and then somebody could interpret the meaning on their own, but then we're going to define it multiple times and have different characters using it and like being like, oh my gosh, this is that thing that you just referred to. In this case, it was Dick Sand.
We came back to that twice.
No. But again, it's like for me, like you say Dick Sand and it's like, got it. Like, you don't have to define it, and then you don't have to, yeah. And it's just that thing of like, okay, got it. You're trying to be simple and fun. You're not offensive. You're just, you're lazy plenty of times. And then you're just kind of trying to go through like a greatest hits of what you've seen in rom-coms. And this one references, it's always weird when a movie goes overboard referencing pop culture.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, we get it. You're from the same world as us. But then whenever you're doing it, for the most part, those things were better than you.
Yeah, that's always the risk.
Yeah, and it's just that thing of like, you know what? Bridget Jones' Diary, you know, yeah. Even Ross season 3, like that was an interesting way to use it, but you're still bringing up things that are more enjoyable than you. And so be careful with that.
I like most of the main characters, and I like that they wind up with what they want. And I do genuinely like that the movie doesn't try to assign what you should want. It doesn't. A lot of these things, a lot of these movies about learning how to be single ultimately come down to, but what you really want to do is find a partner, right? What you really want to do is find in love.
Right.
Which the people who want that do get that, and the people who want a baby get babies, and the people who want to learn how to be single learn how to be single. And I'm in favor of that. I like the different paths they take to their own happiness, and that's fine.
This isn't going to hurt you if you have to go see this with your partner for Valentine's Day.
No, I think it's a B minus. It's recommendable. It's good.
I think it's a 5 out of 10. And again, honestly, one of the things that sealed the deal was that like the pseudo first date into the breakup was just like, come on, people.
That was
one of the worst things you could do.
Yeah. And finally, it's a week of instructions. First it was how to be single, and now it's where to invade next.
Oh, that Michael Moore. He's actually not telling you should invade.
And I was put off by the title because it sounds like it's going to be another movie about war, and honestly, I've heard enough from Michael Moore on that topic. But it turns out it's not that. He's speaking sarcastically. Premise is, you know how we're always going to invading Iraq or whatever or wherever so we can get their oil. Maybe we should find some other countries that have other things we could use and quote unquote invade them and take their ideas. Por ejemplo, Italy got all this paid vacation time and the employees are happier and more productive and so forth. Things like that.
Yes. And he goes to, goodness, how many?
Probably a million countries.
Hang on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I believe he goes to 9 countries.
That sounds about right.
And he, you know, just pretty much it's a complete and utter focus on one or two aspects of that culture.
Right.
And it's not a matter of like, you know, he goes to Germany. He's not saying we should all be German now and do everything that they do. He's just saying, look at that. They have a strong middle class.
There's one particular thing, that they're doing that seems – and more to the point, that seems in line with American ideals, like that go along with what we're trying to do. And here's someone who is doing it, and why don't we learn from that?
And it is eye-opening in the sense of like, oh, somebody figured out how this works. Now, again, it's not a hard and fast rule of like, here you can take all of this. Here's how we implement it. This is the change. Change is a coming. He's just like, hey, notice this.
Yeah.
Doesn't that seem nice? What if we decided we wanted that?
Could we want that? Could we somehow implement that or implement parts of it? Very eye-opening. I learned many things. It's the sort of movie that probably needs to be fact-checked, but I gather that the overall gist of things are true enough. Norway, the maximum prison sentence for anything is 21 years, including the guy who killed like 50 kids on that island a few years ago.
And Norway also
have like nice, more humane prisons. I would say nice. And they have like one of the lowest recidivism rates in the world, whereas we have a very high one.
And that's the thing that Michael Moore does a really good job of is, for the most part, he is showing something that America could work on. Mm-hmm. America could be better in this area. Here's somebody doing great. And it is. It's Italy with vacation days. It's France with school lunches. Oh my gosh!
They take care of the kids and the I wish that he had. I thought he was going to, and then he didn't. Get into more how because of giving the kids healthy school lunches and teaching them about food, how then French people are healthier.
Mm-hmm. But I think he didn't. He have a sentence or two about that. I want to say the French is considering their consumption of wine and smoking, I believe they do live longer.
They do, but I think he didn't really get into that.
Okay.
But then Finland.
Finland with education as well.
No homework. No homework and some of the shortest school days in the Western world, but they're like tops in education.
Right.
In most educated students.
Here's the weird thing about Michael Moore with this movie. I know that he wants to be in his documentaries, but this old lazy lesbian, Michael Moore, he is not photogenic. And he is not. I'm not saying it's just about looks. I'm not that human being. But at the same point, charisma can really go a long way in this issue.
I kept noticing that it's not just the weight thing, although it doesn't help. But he's an unappealing person to look at in the face, and he dresses so sloppily. Meeting with the president of whatever country it was. Some small country, but still a country. And he's meeting with the president and he's there in his t-shirt and his sports coat and his t-shirt's unhooked. He's wearing jeans. It's like, just clean yourself up a little. That's all.
It's actually – his clothes could fit better. And it wouldn't mean that he's a capitalist. He could have a better haircut and it wouldn't mean he's a sellout. Like all of these things. And not only that, a long time ago – in the world that Oprah existed, I believe he was on Oprah talking about how he's finally come to the realization that he needs to take better care of his body because he wants to make a difference. And the best way he can make a difference is to live a longer life so he has more time to make a difference.
Right.
And he just can't get that together. And so I find that annoying when somebody comes to that realization and then can't battle that demon of getting in better shape. I'm not talking about being skinny or like being super fit. I'm just talking about being better. And to top it off, he's playing a character here that doesn't suit him, which is trying to be this uber nice – and a coy individual that has these kid gloves on. He's like, oh, interesting. So this works well. Who would have thought? And he's trying to kill us with kindness. And that's not the Michael Moore that works.
He's not nearly as clever or funny or personable or charismatic or as good of an MC as he thinks he is.
He's amazing.
He gets in his way, in his own way all the time.
He is amazing at finding information that could be relevant to making a better planet or better society. He's great at that.
Many of his interactions with the people that he meets in these countries, I kept thinking, oh, I bet that exchange would have been funny if somebody funny had done it. Like if someone from The Daily Show had been doing this interview, I bet that would have been funny. Yes. Someone other than Micah Moore. I'm always a little uncomfortable. And I know this is his thing. And this is why I think a lot of people will ignore this movie because it's him.
What are you trying to say?
Going to other countries and being like putting the worst possible face on America. Like, yes, the whole point is that we have some problems we could fix, but maybe, you know, explain it in a fairer way, especially if you're talking to people who aren't Americans. Like, you know.
Right.
Be a little cooler about it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He doesn't do – but I do like that in the end it comes around to that these ideas that other countries have are not like foreign crazy ideas. They're – spoiler alert, surprise twist, they were American ideas all along.
Yeah.
And we've just lost sight of them. And
yeah, if you ever want to have an eye-opening look at what our future could have been, Roosevelt had a second Bill of Rights that he was going to put in effect. Never got around to it. Wasn't able to. But it's that idea.
Was that
the
one that had no fat chicks?
No.
All right.
But it's that idea of, wouldn't it be nice if we have tons of money and tons of energy and tons of know-how? Mm-hmm. If we did that to make the world around us better. And it was a thing where it wouldn't it be great if you could work a 40-hour a week job and take care of your family.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that nice to think about?
You mean like America used to have, like in the 50s and 60s? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there's those things. And
all the people in Germany with the middle class working at the pencil factory. None of them have second jobs.
Right.
50% of the boards of directors are made up of actual workers, mm-hmm. which means workers. Oh,
I think there's so many ideas here that I would love to see America shoot for.
So many ideas that the only real reason to reject them is, no, that sounds too European. No, that's socialism. No, that's right. No, we're different. We're America. If we're honest with ourselves, most of these things could be implemented in some way and would improve things for everybody in America.
Well, that's one of the problems with Americans. We don't like to be honest with ourselves. We like to be a little bit delusional overall as a society. Like, one of the things that I was really impressed with Germany was the Holocaust education.
They are big on the Holocaust.
And I can't remember if this movie specifically said it or if I thought it, but it was just like, oh my gosh, if we could point the finger at ourselves better as far as slavery and everything else.
You don't remember if this movie makes that point? Because I thought he went way overboard. That to me was like a digression of getting into just, you know, the genocide of the Indians and slavery and all that. And he's right that we've sort of brushed that aside and act like, it was a long time ago, forget about it. And I don't know that reminding everyone every single day is the solution.
Not,
but somewhere in between
that,
there,
but it's
he's
like
right that we need to
it
not
– in the schools.
Yeah.
To be taught that this is actual history in the schools would shift things.
Instead of what we get, which is that, yes, slavery was a thing and it's over. And really, it wasn't necessarily that bad. Like, a lot of slave masters were nice to their slaves. So, like, you get that sort of whitewashed, diluted.
Yeah, that's not a whip in his hand. It's a magic wand. We can just think of it that way.
So, anyway, where to invade next? Entertaining, enlightening, informative? A little,
could have been a little bit tighter.
Angry making.
It's a full 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a 7 out of 10.
It's a B.
Because I think people should learn about what other countries are doing better than us. I think mm-hmm. that always helps.
All right, now it's time for question of the week.
The question of the week.
Which we're not doing because it's on hiatus. Give it a couple of weeks off. We've asked you, and many of you have responded with suggestions for future questions of the week.
Yeah, we have a good pile going. Mm-hmm. This is nice.
We're going to get a big stack of those piled up. And then next week or the week after or so, bring it back. In the meantime, we have the feature that correlates to Question of the Week called Somebody Asked Us a Thing.
Somebody Asked Us a Thing.
And this is where you ask a question and we answer it. And listener Rob has this question for us. He says, if lots of movies get 5 out of 5, how do you separate the best movies ever? Mission Impossible Rogue Nation was great, but not Raiders of the Lost Ark. I guess he means it was no Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Right.
Should perfect ratings be saved for best of all time or just given when a movie is great? Excellent question. First of all, no movies get 5 out of 5 because that's not our rating system. It's not my rating system. It's not your rating system.
It's closer to mine, but
yeah,
still
yours is 10 out of 10.
Right.
But yes, it's a good question in principle.
Right.
For me, the difference between like an A and an A minus or a B plus, it usually comes down to something that's hard to define. It's just sort of, it's a certain something that the movie has that makes it special.
I would say for me, when I give a 10 out of 10 versus a 9, it's really hard to find something I disliked. It's hard to find something I disliked with a 9 out of 10. It's pretty much impossible. It feels like I'm trying too hard to, find something wrong with a 10 out of 10. Like, it's just like, what would I change? I wouldn't change anything. I love this ride. I can't even believe that I was lifted up to this place. Or, like, I can't believe that scene worked on me so well. That was such a surprise. Like, all of those elements happen with a 10 out of 10. And you just know.
When I was a younger critic, I was very promiscuous with my A grades. If I couldn't think of anything wrong with it.
Yeah.
I was like, that's an A. And then over time, I came to adjust that to be, well, okay, if I can't think of anything wrong with it, then all right, that's a B or a B plus. The A's, my philosophy now is those need to be for the movies that are really excellent. And usually I won't give an A until I've been able to see the movie twice. Because that also for me is that it means that it's going to be rewatchable and it's going to hold up, which is hard to tell on one viewing.
Yeah, and a movie doesn't have to be rewatchable, but that does help to get the 10 out of 10. Like, there's some movies where you're like, I can't revisit that again, or I don't want to revisit that for 5 years because it, like, had this special thing going for me at the time. That's the thing, too. A lot of times a 10 out of 10 for me could be – there's something going on in my life that really was brought to light because of the movie's subject, yeah, or something like that. And it's like, this is a personal 10 out of 10. Maybe it's only going to be a 9 for other people or an 8 for other people, but there's great reasons for me to consider it a 10.
Yeah.
Mad Max was a 9 the first time I saw it. And I've watched it so many times since and loved it so many times that I don't necessarily know if it's a 10. But it is a 10 now because of what it means to me now, just the fact that the movie exists, the layers with it, and everything else. But there was moments of it where it was just like, all right, I could see a little bit of a pacing flaw in this one particular scene or something to that effect. But it is interesting. I actually feel like I was stingier with my 9s and 10s in the beginning.
Oh, yeah?
And I've become a little bit more relaxed with it. But that's probably just because I love more because now I have kids. Like, that's probably what's going on there.
I'm cutting that out. I'm going to start cutting out every reference you make to your children on the show.
Did you know I have 2 boys now?
Yeah, I think we have slightly different philosophies, which is fine. I like that.
Yes, I think we do too.
Because I usually try not to let, oh, this is for me personally, this makes it better. I try to usually separate myself from that, and not always successfully, but that's just my own preference for how I like to do things. But it's,
yeah. And for me, I would rather talk about that. Like, yes, I'm giving it a 9 out of 10. But like, I could totally see somebody coming at this from a different place and not,
right.
I'd rather talk about that and still give it that 9, because for me, it really does come down to like, how much was I entertained by it? And then the secondary, of course, is who's the best audience for this movie? Like, hey, who should I really tell to see this?
Right.
Like, that sort of thing.
The and of course the grades and the scores are all arbitrary, and I always used to get amused. It hasn't happened a lot lately, but where people be like, you know, you wrote this rave review, but it's only gave it an A-. Why not an A?
Right.
What difference does it make? And it comes down to Roger Ebert. Someone asked Roger Ebert about it, and I can't find the exact quote. But what he said was that it basically came down to an ineffable tingle in the spine. Like, that's the difference for him between a 3.5-star and a 4-star.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, don't read too much into it. But I try to reserve the very top grades for movies that I think are going to hold up.
And I'd say for me, a 10 out of 10 probably only happens 1 to 4 times a year.
Yeah.
Like, that's probably it for me. So maybe that's – and I don't necessarily – I don't try for that to occur. But for the most part, that's kind of what I expect. I expect to see just a small handful of great movies every year.
Yeah.
And then hopefully a ton of really good movies.
Right. I think that's about how I feel. I agree. And so there you go. Thanks for your question, Rob. And thus concludes this week's segment of Somebody Asked Us a Thing.
Mm-hmm.
So to recap, our lunch sponsor, don't forget our lunch sponsor. He wrote that book.
The 99 Center?
Mm-hmm. It's over at Amazon.
For 99 free?
Cents. We'll put the link on our Facebook and on our website and stuff. And let me find his thing again now. There he is. Kevin Duncan. That's his name. And the book is called The Little Scary Book. It's $1 on Amazon. And it's free if you got the Kindle Unlimited, whatever that is.
Yeah, that's not the Prime, right? It's something beyond.
No, it's something else, yeah. But it's only available through Prime. Amazon Kindle, by the way.
Oh, Beyond Prime will definitely be like the name of some sci-fi thing at some point.
Prime.
Beyond Prime.
So thank you, Kevin Duncan, and The Little Scary Book for sponsoring us.
It's just a little scary book.
Just a little. And then also, Deadpool is fun.
It is.
Yeah. And that's it. Zoolander 2. Yeesh.
Don't see it.
How to Be Single. Not bad.
Eh. It could be worse.
It could be worse. And then Where to Invade Next is good, solid documentary. Thought-provoking stuff. If you want to have your thoughts provoked.
That's right.
Which, you know who you are if you do. Not everybody's into that. And so, yeah, please continue to give us suggestions for questions of the week, and we'll come back to that soon. And that's it. Anything else you want to add?
I don't think so. I think that's it for me.
Okay. Well, that's it for me, too, then. So, for Movie BS with Baron Snyder, I'm Eric D. Snyder.
I am Jeff Baer.
Thanks for listening, and good day.
I said good day.